Well, our guest now is a passion for sustainability and gardening, which served as the catalyst for a PhD on Christchurch's extensive and proud green-fingered history. Matt Morris has now broadened that out in a new book, Common Ground, Garden Histories of Aotearoa. He explores the ways in which cultural meanings have been embedded in the land through the way New Zealanders have gardened over the centuries. While a lot of gardening books focus on the grand plots, Matt Morris is more captivated by the historical processes behind humble gardens. This includes tales of the earliest Polynesian settlers bringing with them seeds and cuttings, dig for victory efforts, and how home gardening has fared across the decades. His focus is on land planted and cultivated and maintained by ordinary people, rather than the gardens of the wealthy. This increasingly includes the emergence of community initiatives and a growing interest in food sovereignty. Kia ora and welcome to 9 to Noon, Matt.
Kia ora, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Of your own passion for gardening, I presume you do. How far back?
How far back does my passion for gardening go?
Yeah, your own gardening.
I grew up in suburban Christchurch, and I know that my mum has a story of me lying down on the concrete facing the veggie garden one day with my hands in my head on my hands and just kind of staring at the garden when I was probably about 5 or 6, and I was there for a very long time, and she came out and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm watching the courgettes grow, you know, because at that time of the year they grow so fast." And I thought, well, if I stay here long enough, I'll actually see it happening. And I don't remember that, but it is the kind of thing I would do. So
that's a great story.
It goes back quite a way.
Yeah. And as we said, there was a Christchurch focus initially for you. This included some of the early garden trusts and community gardening initiatives, yes?
That's right. So I actually spent some time working in that area, starting in the late 1990s. I was working for an organisation called the Organic Garden City Trust, and the idea of that, it was really the brainchild of Vicky Buck, who was mayor of Christchurch at the time, and she thought Christchurch could be the first organic garden city in the world. And so a trust was set up, and I worked for that, and it completely changed my perspective on the world. It opened my eyes to all sorts of amazing things that were happening in the community. At that time, community gardens weren't really that well known, and if you talked about them, it was a bit like, oh yeah, okay, interesting. So things have really changed, haven't they? Because it's community gardens and all sorts of community food projects are flourishing around the country, and it's great to see.
It's really good time to be doing a history because, as you say, things are changing rapidly right now, and we are reevaluating our literal connections with the land in so many ways. So Christchurch, the backbone, obviously, of your previous work and also of this, but tell me, let's begin with Christchurch, and tell me how you've gone about building a history. Obviously, there are archives and there are photographs, but you did a lot of talking to people. And to whom did you talk?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the way that I worked was initially to do to look at the archives, and in particular for Christchurch, I spent a lot of time looking at the Christchurch Press and reading, you know, these fabulous gardening columns from the 1860s and 70s and right through. And so I gleaned a lot of information from that about what was being said, you know, the kinds of instructions that people were being given in order to grow a good garden. But I wanted to ground truth that with the experience of actual gardeners, and it's quite tricky to do that for the 1860s, 1870s. Obviously, there's not too many people around, but there are lots of great diaries. So I just started digging into settlers' diaries and where I could, and found out some interesting things from them. But then, as you know, I kind of moved through the periods, I was able to start interviewing people, and it was really brilliant. I really love talking to older people about the gardens of their childhood, and everybody seems to have some kind of connection to a garden place, and Yeah, so that's what I did for the Christchurch study, and it is the backbone for the book. I then started talking to people all over the country and collecting some great stories, and it's just delightful. It's such a nice project to do.
Well, I wonder if we sort of move chronologically and then we can just deviate as we want to. Obviously, how far back could you trace the origins of gardening as it's been done in Aotearoa since humans came here? How far back could you go?
The book starts in the 13th century, kind of nominally, and you know, it's a funny sort of thing to condense the first few hundred years of gardening history into the first chapter, and then the rest of it is, 19th, 20th century history. But I'm lucky because there's been some great archaeological work done already and great ethnographic work as well. So it's not that early period is not really my specialty, but there's a lot of material there to draw on. So I felt that it was very important to begin there because I have been, also wanting to acknowledge the great work of other garden historians already. But there is a thing that happens, which is, which is to assume that gardening history really starts in New Zealand with the arrival of people from Britain who were great gardeners, and maybe a bit of preface about, there were other people here as well that were gardening beforehand. But I felt, it's tricky when doing history, isn't it? Because there's always something that happened before that created some context for the thing that happens next. So in a way, I've fallen into the trap as well. But I wanted to be able to talk about that very rich history of gardening pre-European contact in Aotearoa, and then also not just simply stop at 1840 with telling the the Maori gardening story, and then move into the British story. I wanted to be able to I wanted to see what the effects on Maori gardening of the colonial period were, and then to understand something about how it is that there is still a really strong Maori gardening tradition happening here. How did that continue and who was responsible? So a bit of a jumble there, but really what I'm, you asked when did I start, how early can you go?
It would be
about the 13th century. Yeah.
Well, as you said, there are other histories being written. I don't know if you heard that amazing interview with Manu Paul, who just blew my mind recently with Maori gardening traditions, I guess, and practices. So, you can't do everything in a history, and I hear you almost apologising for that, but I don't think you need to. You move through various significant eras, though, and I wonder if we could touch on one or two of them. When did we start to see, because the European settlers, of course, it's certainly an organised settlement, would have been what, in the first instances, fairly reliant on the gardening that was already happening here and what was already grown here. When did we start to see cuttings and seeds brought here that may have changed how gardening happened and what was being grown?
For the European part of the story, plants, seeds especially were coming in from the very beginning. So James Cook brought seeds and started a little garden, and there's a whole lot of mythology around that. The first potatoes arrived here in 1790s, and but it was Maori gardeners who took these plants on and nurtured them and grew them, and then kind of realised, there's more people coming. We should, there will be something in it for us if we grow this stuff because there's market. And so you're right. I mean, the early settlers, when they did eventually start turning up, arrived in a place where there were plenty of familiar foods for them to eat. And then something, you know, and they were quite reliant on the Māori gardeners, but then gradually started to become more independent of them and bring their own gardens. And there was an early trade, plants, fruit trees, tubers and so on were coming in from Sydney quite early, even 1840s, 1850s, there was quite a thriving market. And then a little bit later, when Wardian cases became a thing, live plants were being shipped around the world in this quite very complex web of plant exchange, all really to do with Kew and the, you know, the British imperial system. But
Kew Gardens,
yeah.
So some of those early seeds yielded plants which in 2020 are sort of really they speak to our past, don't they? And they're heritage varieties of all kinds, yeah?
Yes, and it's kind of remarkable actually how much has survived, and it's really thanks to the efforts of invisible armies of seed savers that some of those what we now call heritage plants are still with us. So I'm tremendously grateful for them, to them for doing that. But it's lovely reading back through some of the old records, and you see, giant asparagus and walking onions and all sorts of things that seem quite alien now. But what has really struck me a lot is how proficient people in the 19th century, for example, were with in their gardens. Very, huge ranges of vegetables that people could grow. Tons of different kinds of cabbages, for example, and then lots of very specialised equipment. So that really speaks to that high level of skill that that a lot of people had back then, which just diminished gradually as the 20th century wore on.
One of the themes that runs through the book, and you've alluded it to already, is land. Who has access to land, who has knowledge, and then what happens with the individualisation of land and land parcels throughout the era of colonisation. So this is another thing. Did the who was gardening where and how changed massively?
Yes, absolutely.
Along with everything else.
Along with everything else, it was a complete, obviously a complete transformation. But and the kind of the mode of the transformation differed by place, by region around the country, depending on whether you're kind of mixed up in the wars in the north or not. To me, one of the questions that's been in my head, and I suppose it's one of the one of the drivers for me to be involved in this kind of work is that question of equity and justice, and the book doesn't really kind of bang on about this too much, but it seems to me that it's we need to ask the question, what do you need in order to have a garden? And one of the things would be land. So seems very obvious, I guess, but that gradual transfer, sometimes not gradual, sometimes quite dramatic and fast, but anyway, the transfer of land from, Māori ownership to owned by the New Zealand government or individualised, had a very profound effect on not just Māori gardening, but on that overall garden history of New Zealand. But I think also there's a really important point in there about the question of that idea of land ownership, which was in some ways alien to Māori prior to colonisation, and the very concerted effort to individualise parcels of Māori land so that so that the colonial project could proceed, because the idea of collective ownership of land and the idea of collective ownership of land really was a concept that was incompatible with the colonial project, I guess. And I'm very interested in this because now there's a kind of call or an interest in a return to the commons, and I mean, we were talking before a little bit about community gardening and community investment in managing public space through community gardening, for example.
It's very timely, Matt, because two things. First, we talk about the price of vegetables and the price of feeding a family when you're trotting off to a supermarket or even to a market. So there is at its heart a very practical reason for gardening, and that is to grow food. And second, which is a strange thing to feel the need to say, but in our contemporary world where we've got supermarkets every few metres, many of us have abandoned that skill and fundamental approach. The second thing that's changed that's really worth discussion now is the quarter acre home. The quarter acre property is a thing of the past for many, many people. And so the next question comes, can you grow? And if so, where and how can more people grow? So speak, if we just leap forward, speak a little bit more to what you are seeing happening now with community initiatives and for those who do have a patch of land, a drive again to produce more. What have you seen happen and when?
Yeah, great. I mean, I love the stuff, that whole sort of notion of food sovereignty or food security, food resilience is a huge passion for me. We definitely saw an upswing in people starting to grow food at home around the time of the global financial crisis. So, you know, that economic impact really did stimulate people to come back to growing food again. There'd been a lot of conversation towards that, in that direction for some time, but the GFC really did stimulate, sort of catalyze something. And I guess where I am here in Christchurch, the earthquakes, 2010, 2011, etc., just kind of rammed that home again. We cannot necessarily rely on supermarkets to solve all our food problems because food supply can be interrupted so quickly and it's so vulnerable, actually, when we're kind of in the midst of these global food chains. But supermarkets don't actually hold that much food, and sometimes, anyway, they just close suddenly, like what happened in the earthquakes. And I guess COVID as well has been another reminder of this. This is, we're in a time of huge transition, and in terms of food security, growing food, having food being produced close to where you are is definitely kind of one of the key ingredients. So for people who don't have much land, and there's lots of reasons for that, but. We also are seeing a burgeoning community gardening movement, and we've actually just a group of community gardeners around the country have put together the very first New Zealand community garden census, I guess you could call it, which was rolled out May and June, I think this year. And what we can see is that around 60% of the people who responded to that survey of 200 or so had started the community garden since 2010. So there's just been this massive growth over the last 10 years in these kind of community food resilience projects, which is, as you say, it's very timely, but there's a reason they're happening because we need them.
That's There's an extraordinary range of stories in the book and information in the book, from the war effort, dig for victory, to characters like William Cabbage Wilson and his contribution to what was happening in Christchurch in the mid 19th century. You talk about the rise in toxins also, and this is another thing. If you think of home gardening, let alone commercial gardening, at what point did we really begin to use lots of sprays and to kill pests and various kinds of fertilisers. Was there a big transition point at some point, perhaps pushed by what was being commercially produced?
Well, I'd say the short answer to that is yes, and I'd probably point to the 1950s as a time when this kind of idea of scientific gardening came in, and that is, you know, suddenly the suburban expansion, people having these lovely lawns and a bit more space, perhaps. But yeah, this idea that you need to be very careful about what gets into your garden. And so this massive array of chemicals suddenly came on the market, and people saying, you know, the garden experts kind of indicating you must use this, you must use that to keep down this or that pest. But what I found through my interviews was a heartening reluctance to buy into that. I'm not saying people didn't use any kinds of sprays. I know they certainly did. But I don't think that most gardeners really kept a massive arsenal of chemicals in their gardening shed. You know, a few, but most people that I spoke to remembered things like Deris dust and, you know, and a couple of other sort of key ones. But so that was interesting for me. There's a certain resistance or a reluctance to just use whatever is being, you know, whatever the experts are saying you should do. People go, okay, well, maybe a bit of that, but I'm not buying into your whole agenda.
Matt, I'm going to ask you to come back another time, if you don't mind, because I want to look a little bit more at another project you're working on, and I think in the residential red zone, because we know there's a lot of interesting things happening with the former red zone land, and are you involved in an initiative to try and have a quite significant garden development there? Is that a happening thing?
There is a huge push to see the residential red zone kind of reconceptualized as a food basket for the region, and that doesn't mean, you know, kind of covering the whole.
No, I know the sensitivities.
But you're right. Yeah, so the idea of weaving pockets of food production through that space is, there's a lot of interest in that and a lot of progress being made.
Come back as things develop, because the idea of more and more, not only community gardens, allotment-style gardens, which are a bit more organised even than community gardens, but the idea of growing edible foods as part of the greening of our cities is a really interesting area as well. So please come back as things progress.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. You're welcome, and congratulations on the book. Matt Morris, Common Ground, Garden Histories of Aotearoa. He has published Otago University Press, the publisher.